If you read Hosea, all of it in one go, don't stop at one chapter or one portion. You will notice that there are strange vocabulary of God marrying Israel, and Israel is his wife, who became totally unfaithful, went after foreign gods, and we have that unusual definition of idol worship in the Old Testament. It's called adultery.
Adultery,
which is a sexual expression of unfaithfulness. And yet the adulterous Israel is called back to a renewed marriage. I don't know from what I hear on the internet and read in the in contemporary books, how far and how deep is the God as the bridegroom of Israel is very well known in our meetings. I don't know. It doesn't seem to be a very well known theme. Am I right?
I'd say it's true that we don't think about God being the bride of Israel the way, I mean, we hear about the church being the bride of Christ, but we never hear about Israel being the bride of God.
The bridegroom, actually, God is the bridegroom. Because, you see, we have a term called covenant, berith in Hebrew. But the covenant technically is like a treaty in modern times. You know, like a treaty between the Allies and, say, Soviet Union in the past. But berith is a marriage contract. A covenant is a marriage contract. And you have here quotations from the prophets, which I hope you read and contemplate. Of all the prophets, actually, not just Hosea, there is a quotation I put from the Midrash Rabbah on Exodus. You have it on first page immediately. The word is betrothal, but the wedding will be in the days of the Messiah. You got that? You see?
So in this world, we are betrothed, and this world is the betrothal.
Yeah, and then the wedding day when the Messiah comes, there will be a wedding. And you know, just jog your memory. What was the first miracle that Jesus performed at the beginning of his ministry?
Wedding of wine. And isn't it interesting that Mary and Joseph were only betrothed?
Yes. Because you see, there is that subtle way of talking which in a sense seems to be unfamiliar to us. And because it is unfamiliar, we try to pass over and go to the familiar things. Now, what would be the wedding in Ezekiel and Isaiah and Jeremiah and Hosea and the other prophets? What will be the actual wedding relationship between God and Israel? That God cannot break a promise. And if he gets angry, it's an angry of a jealous husband. You know?
I don't
know. No. You have to ask a Jew, and he will tell you.
In other words, it's not revenge.
No, you see, Revenge comes from the Middle Ages, Christian Middle Ages, and the hardness of heart that we developed when we married theology with the civil understanding of life. But in the Old Testament, all of it, honestly, you know, sometimes when I'm in a church and the preacher is talking the Old Testament, I pray that the Lord have mercy on me so I can sleep. Simply because they make a mess.
Would this anger, the jealousy of a husband, would that only be after the law had come into place?
Before the law and after the law.
It is
in the garden. It's a creation. Look, there's a very subtle question I have to ask you. Why Genesis said to us that God created man according to his own image? That you and me are the image of God. What was insinuated in that expression? You know, Christian understanding gives me headache. Sorry. Oh, we are his image because in righteousness, in wisdom, in, I don't know, a lot of rubbish. No, why I give you my image? Oh, I love you, that's the most obvious thing. But what is the subtle, insinuated agenda in...
Part of it. Understanding?
Come on, dig more than that. You know, I give you my image because I want you to be in a marriage relationship. Yes. That's why I put the unrelenting love of God. And I really looked at the dictionaries to select the English word. Because, you know, the chesed of God, where he really unbroken love and continues in spite of what the other side will do. Or he will get angry, sends them to exile, you know, like a husband gets angry and kicks his wife out. So he sends her to Babylon. I'll bring her back. He cannot forget that he is the bridegroom of ancient Israel. Okay. I am not going to dwell on the Jewish side, which I know extremely well, and it is joyful. It makes me read the Old Testament with great joy, even when I come across events where there is a real anger, you know. Okay, we'll leave that. Perhaps we come to that later on. Now, where do you see the wedding between Jesus and the church in the New Testament? Why Jesus called the bridegroom? Number one, obviously, it is a continuation of what the prophet said. Isn't that what John is saying, you know? That Jesus is the bridegroom, and he is only the friend of the bride, the bridegroom, right? Okay. But let me jog your memory again. What was the most striking parables by Jesus about the kingdom? No. Weddings. The wedding feast.
The what?
Wedding feast. Wedding feast. Why bring the wedding feast into the good news? Because he's saying, I come to renew that. And now, to make it more solid and eternal than ever. In the ancient Christian tradition, the incarnation is the marriage between God and humanity. But I don't believe that we heard that before, have you?
The incarnation of Christ is the wedding.
Is the marriage.
Marriage.
is the marriage. And what takes place after is the actual wedding. You know, how that marriage took place, and there is a big celebration of the wedding. Where do you think that wedding was celebrated? In the most obvious way, in a very subtle way. Why Christ was wearing a crown when he was crucified? Because he's a bridegroom. We think, you know, Christian fancy ideas, that the soldiers wanted, oh, you are the, listen to this, you are the king of Israel, we give you a crown. But the crown is in the prophecies about the bridegroom. Okay, do you remember that when the soldiers took off the tunic of Jesus, do you remember the specific description of the tunic in the Gospel of John? Aha! Thank you, Jeff. It was seamless. It's what a bridegroom will wear for his wedding night. What a high priest will wear also on Yom Kippur. You know, the only thing that is unusual, that the wedding took place at the cross. You know, it was a big celebration, obviously. And you read it in a subtle way, which echoes the Old Testament, you know, or echoes the Old Testament. You saw echo or echo? How do you say it in English?
What?
Is it echo or echo?
Echo,
okay.
Echo.
Echo.
Echo. Okay. Listen to this. Colossians chapter 1. I bet you read it 100 times.
And missed it.
No. Nobody told you. You didn't miss it. No, you just, you pass over it because it doesn't catch.
Okay.
Verse 15 onwards to verse 19. Come on, Mr. Reader. There's no time for quietness for you.
Very well.
To 19.
He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell.
20.
And through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross.
Now, things in heaven and on earth were reconciled by Christ. It was the wedding feast that restored creation to a full communion with God. Okay? That description requires a whole night. Firstborn, image, invisible, all that. But you know, he creates and then he comes to redeem. If you are a musician, I'm not a musician, I love music. I learned a little bit about music. He creates, isn't he? Keeps things together and then he comes to redeem them. Where do you see that in the Bible other than the text? In the Old Testament. Because Creator and Redeemer are the two major powers that are manifested by the one God in the Bible. And that redemption is a completion of our creation. Our creation is useless without redemption. It is God's plan to redeem. But then, what escaped the notice of our commentators, to reconcile to himself. Did you notice? To reconcile to himself everything on earth and everything on heaven. Okay. On earth, we made a big mess out of it. Never mind. What about heaven? Why heaven had to be reconciled with us through Jesus Christ? Why?
Run that by again.
Why heaven need to be reconciled by the blood of the cross?
Heaven was blood.
What?
Why did it defile by Satan?
I'm glad you're scratching, you know. Keep scratching.
Why did heaven have to be redeemed?
Yes. Actually, redeemed means to complete its creation. You know, when we think of redemption, this is what Christianity did to you. I'm sorry. I am a Christian, but what you always think of sin, don't you? Can you spit on it once? Can you forget it? That's what I mean. Can you forget it? You know, you think redemption is about sin. No. Redemption is about completing your existence. Of course there is sin in the way, but that's a minor issue. So the minor issue became a bigger issue. You are glad to hear that?
Well, I'm glad to hear that sin is the minor issue.
Absolutely. You know, you really think, oh my goodness, I recorded over 150 sermons from different churches throughout the whole USA. They made me sick. Honestly, really made me sick. When you go to the YouTube, I'm not going to tell you which church. When you go to YouTube, there's a sermon called "What is the Gospel?" I mean, it just gives the title. Forget about the name and the church. It's here in Indiana. That's all I can say to you. Anyhow, 25 minutes, all about sin. Redemption. Because behind that, do you remember the great American psychologist Eric Fromm and another man starts with the letter F? Remember his name?
You're not thinking of Freud or
No, not Freud. He's an American. Frankel. Thank you. Frankel. Frankel came with an issue still with us about how our language will shape our awareness and our attitude to ourselves. That he said one means, not the only one means of defeating even a trauma is to change your words to a better words. A better vocabulary. Instead of calling your wife the old car, that's an example he gave actually in a lecture. Call her the beautiful flower, the red rose, you know? Because he said, you know, we are trapped by magnifying our problems. And the more we magnify our problems, the less we discover a solution. Obviously, because you know it becomes so huge that We look for a solution, we can't see it. And he said, well, the solution is so close to you, closer than your nose. You know, your nose that is stuck into your...
redemption is about completing our creation.
Yeah, because you see, in Hebrew, bara, to create. And bara is to redeem also.
Sin's a minor issue. What are the major issues? What, I mean, if you
spend... The major issue? The unrelenting love. The faithfulness of God. It comes under a veneer of the Anglo-Saxon vocabulary. The righteousness of God. And the righteousness of God was taken to be His penal justice. What a disaster.
George, I have a question, if you don't mind. With nuns being called the brides of Christ, was that tapping into the relationship that you're talking about?
Yes, yes, yes. You know, while when you say righteous, God is righteous in Hebrew, it means He is faithful. He is true. But when it comes into the Anglo-Saxon through Latin, it becomes justice. And justice rings a bell in our head. It's about the law. Right? Frankl is not wrong after all. Because, you know, the language that we use can really, seriously reshape our awareness and reshape our relationship also. I'm just told his example. Don't call your wife the old car. You know, call her the red rose. And he said, then you have a nice breakfast. Then the washing machine is working and she will give you a kiss and a hug. Truly. You know, if I stick a label on you and that label is permanent, it's not something temporary, do you really think you can grow out of it? No. But if I change it, in myself and in my communion with you, then things will go further. Now, let's look according to Frankl to the parables of Jesus. Do you know one single parable that has violence in it? No.
Good Samaritan guy gets beat up.
The Good Samaritan? Violence?
Well,
where he is preaching violence? Where he is preaching violence through a parable?
He's not preaching violence. He said, asked if there was violence. And
no.
You know,
no.
Violence at the start of that.
No. A parable about violence. A parable about hatred, how I hate my brother?
No.
Oh, what you're saying is there's not been anything, no parable that has been about violence.
Right.
Or hatred.
Yeah.
Or hatred.
Or what?
Or hatred. Or sin.
That's true.
You know?
Why?
Because it is a good news. My good grief. It's a good news. I come to tell you good news. You are a sinner and you are going to hell. That's good news.
It's a little shame for a lot
of text. Never mind, but you know, that's the good news. You are a sinner and going to hell. Really?
Thank you.
My goodness. Okay. The parable. Yes. Yes. Go ahead.
I'm backing up a little. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, I'm not sorry.
I had a question about heaven needing to be redeemed. Yeah.
I'm coming.
Okay.
Say more about that. Okay. Thank you, sir. Thank you. Where do you see heaven in Christian worship? We don't need that whiskey anymore.
Where do we see
heaven in Christian
worship?
Much in the drum set, I think.
Bob, stop being funny. Okay. Just slow down, slow down. What? Sorry? What did you say? That is part of the slice, but I need the whole melon. I'm greedy. Okay, there is a season coming very soon called Christmas. Right? Christmas. God save me from Christmas.
I can't believe you're bringing it up already.
Okay. What was the song recorded by Luke for the birth of Jesus? What did the angel sing? Glory be to God on high and on earth peace. Now, glory be to God on high. I'm sorry, I don't like the English. But I have to speak it, otherwise I have to go back and live in Israel. What's glory? How beautiful is God in His dealing with us? Because now there is peace on earth. What is peace on earth is Jesus, actually. You know, that is the only virtue I have over you, which does make me proud of myself. Is that I read Aramaic and Hebrew, so I clean my head from the legalistic language. And you know, good pleasure in human beings. Why? Because human beings now, there's a human being united to the Godhead. That's a pleasure. Had his pleasure in being human. Okay? So what is heaven here? Someone met Jesus in the Gospel of John, and when he called him, and he said, from now you see heaven open, remember? And the angels are ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Why heaven has been opened? When was the first opening publicly? Baptism of Jesus. Before that, the angels coming for the Christmas season, right? Okay. When was the greatest opening which brought everything heavenly to us? Pentecost. I'm playing my tricks on you because you are addicted to preaching.
What about the transfiguration?
Oh, don't run. Look. Don't run. Walk slowly. Listen carefully to Paul. Forget about me.
Well, that's easy because you stop thinking about the preachers.
Listen to Paul. In Colossians again. Chapter 3, verse 1. Yeah. Yes, sir.
If then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God.
You see, if you think above means in that blue color called the sky, that's very childish. That's heaven. Okay, where Christ is seated, continue please, brother.
Where Christ is seated at the right hand of God.
Yeah?
Set your minds on things that are above, not on the things that are on earth.
Yeah, exactly. It is a transformation of our own vision. where all the heavenly things that came with Jesus, we can see them even when you're driving on the meridian or going to buy a pair of jeans from Kohl's or whatever, you know, or shop in the mall. Because you see, what do you see? The reflection of heaven, even in the secular field, beauty, quality, right? What's beauty and quality are? They are fragments of the eternal. But commercially, we relate them to the money, to the prices, to the brand, isn't it? But there is still, I like to buy this because it is really beautiful. And it is also durable, stays longer, you know. Simply because it's a very nice fabric. The tailoring is good. Something like that. Why are we seeking the good and the beautiful and the better? It's our hunger for heaven.
Our hunger from heaven.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Why beauty? That's Aristotle. Why beauty does not need an evidence, an argument? Beauty.
It can't be defined.
No, you can't argue because it's so obvious. It's so obvious. And you know, peace. Why joy and peace? You know, when you are on a holiday, I remember once we were in Florida and we walked on the beach after sunset, there was nobody there. There was an eternal peace. Heaven was there. And you know, when we say in prayers, in the name of Jesus Christ, we actually enter the heavenly realm where there is the beauty and the peace and the reconciliation and the forgiveness, since because you love sins too much. Okay, and forgiveness of sins. Okay, I added to it. You know? Why you come to church and then you leave the church all rejuvenated? Does it happen to you? Happy. You eat your donut and drink your coffee and you feel that the day is fantastic. It's a touch of the spirit in your inner heart, but you took it on the bodily side. You did not follow it through to the where Christ is seated at the right hand of God the Father. Isn't that did it ever happen to you? When you hear a hymn, nice hymn, with nice melody, you feel that you are no longer in that box called the body. Where that desire to transcend and enter into the joy, it's heaven. What do you think heaven is? A mall?
Mall, M-A-L-L.
No. Heaven is where it's joy and peace and love and union. That's heaven. So our Lord came to tell us, I am the bridegroom. I walk to the cross, and I quoted Mr. Augustine for you. Oh Lord, save my soul. On page 3. On page 3 on the top. You see, even the disciples were depicted as the sons of the bride chamber, right? Which is vivid description of the time of the Messiah who will be crowned as a bridegroom at his crucifixion on his wedding day. Now, please, read the text from Augustine, please.
Like a bridegroom, Christ went forth from his nuptial chamber, He came even to the marriage bed of the cross, and there, ascending it, he consummated a marriage. He surrendered himself to the torment of his body in a communication of love.
What do you think? Good Friday. How do we celebrate Good Friday? I looked at the great Ephraim the Syrian. It is the wedding day between the soul and Jesus. Ephraim the Syrian. And I think I'll give you the text next week, because it is almost 300 pages and I need to...
No, but that, there's something here that I bet most of us are thinking, we're not, when we think of nuptial and consummation of marriage, it's a sexual thing.
Oh, yes.
But going back to your thing, that it's also a completion thing.
Oh, yes. What made sex dirty?
What made or made?
Makes sex that in our even our time.
Giving yourself away.
No. Make it dirty. What makes it dirty? You will be surprised. It's our own guilt.
Our own guilt.
Yes. Our own guilt. We all have a little bit of it. I have it. You have it. Everybody have it. And you know, because is it really the self-giving? The most sacred act of love. It cannot be dirty, it cannot be unholy. But you know, because of the unfaithfulness, because of the infidelity, because of so many things, we looked at it. I mean, I recall, in English, I don't know American jokes, but I know plenty of English jokes about sex. They all demean it.
They all demean it?
Oh, yes, like rubbish. It's not rubbish. Have we all forgotten that we are the product of that rubbish? Out of that rubbish we all have been created? Where do you come from? From a tube? They're working on it. Yeah, they're working on it, you know. And I don't know how successful is that. But, you know, there is that sense, you know, it's a man and a woman meeting in order to produce life. But, you know, all the guilt and the occults and the black magic and came like big army squeezing a little tiny warriors and kill them. I don't know. I've been asked to give a talk about sex in a high school, and I am double-minded. You know why? Because my vocabulary, my attitude is alien to American culture. I sat with the teacher and I said, I'm really thinking very hard not to go. I don't want any of you to be in the newspapers or to be taken to court.
Or you.
I don't know. Me possibly, you know. Simply because innocence is lost. Look, I'm going to ask you something really horrible. And you have to forgive me. What is the meaning of politically correct in true Christian morality? You know my answer? You want to be neutral between evil and good.
That's
and there is no neutrality.
Between evil and good.
No neutrality between good and evil. Absolute rubbish. You can't. And when you do it, you become a hypocrite. You know? And the main issue is lost. You know, being politically correct. Well, simply, I can't. Evil is evil and good is good. And you know, the way we cross between the two, try to be politically correct.
See, and that's what's really good about what you just said, is that the political correct crowd is always going to go to your opinion. It will deny the existence of objective truth.
Huh?
And this would allow that, that, you know, this is evil, that's good. Well, that's just your opinion. You know, one man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist, kind of thing.
Yeah. I don't know. Look, in the parables of Jesus, in the parables of Jesus, all of them, you sense the lack of neutrality. Absolutely. There is no neutrality. No. The prodigal son and the big brother. Between them is the goodness of the Father. And there's nothing in between. Other than the goodness. And the goodness is the good. The father cannot be politically correct. Even his answer to the older brother. Absolutely sharp. No neutrality. The good Samaritan that you mentioned. You know, Bob, if you are a Jew in a crowd and hear Rabbi from Nazareth called Jesus telling the parable, your blood pressure will shoot up. Simply because they hate the Samaritans. He should have been politically correct and made the man a Jew. But look at the subtle way. The man who was caught by the robbers, we don't know his ethnic origin. A man going to Jericho could be Samaritan, merchant, could be a Jew.
Oh, that's good too. You probably thought of that, didn't you? The victim in that parable.
No ethnic background. No ethnic background. But the man who's good is ethnically defined as a Samaritan. On the other side, the priest and the Levi. And these are the cream of the society of the Jews. Okay? Because the law doesn't allow them to do first aid to the wounded man. That is absolutely true. Because if they touch a wound, they become unclean. That is certainly absolutely correct. And they are right. Oh, yes, according to the law, yes. Well, here comes someone said, oh, no, there is that infidel. Samaritan took him, cleaned his wound, made him unclean according to the law. Put him on his donkey, whatever, and even paid for the inn.
On credit.
On credit, you know.
They trusted.
And then he says, whom do you think is his kin blood? Actually, the word is his neighbor, knows his, or his friend. No, but the Aramaic word, the one who belongs to him by blood belonging from the same tribe. And the answer is the one who did good to him. See?
So are you saying the victim was a Samaritan?
Of course. The Samaritan is no longer a Samaritan in their definition. But the Samaritan is the best. Because he did what? Mercy. And you know, the cry of the prophets in the entire Old Testament, God is saying, I need mercy and not sacrifice. Yeah. I need mercy, yeah. Not sacrifice.
Where is that?
In all of them, all the prophets. Oh, my goodness. Oh, Lord. If I open the file of Judaism, we will never end, you know. Because this is why I keep saying, when Derek was here, I begged him to open a rabbinic school. And he said, what are you going to do? I said, I will teach proper Judaism. And he said, how does this serve Christianity? And said, it serves Christianity very well. But you know, in his own heart, he could not accept that simply because how could rabbinic school in Jewish teaching serve the New Testament? My goodness, it serves the New Testament very well. And then I said, I'll open my house, you know, locally. And then I tried with four school, from the school teachers from two different churches. They came twice and then they ran away. They actually ran away. I kept saying, well, I'm sorry.
Okay, so on the Samaritan thing, you know, that parable is an answer to the question, who is my neighbor?
Yes.
So the man then is unidentified because he's just your neighbor. Does it matter who the man is?
No, it's a man is my neighbor because he did the good. Not because of his ethnic background, not because keeping the law. And you know, look, is there a neutrality in the parable of the Good Samaritan?
No.
Was Jesus politically correct?
No.
Ah, he even said that the priest and the Levi, you know, indirectly lack mercy. They want to keep the law because the law gives them a lazy mind.
Gives them what?
Lazy mind.
A lazy mind.
Yeah. He's a wounded man. I don't want to do with him, you know. I'll become unclean. It's easy. Okay. Go and attend his wounds and become unclean to the evening and then do your purification and then you can pray afterwards. No!
It's easy way. To say it, and it's not easy to do it.
Yeah, well.
That's why they wanted the law to do it.
Okay. So, here is in the bridegroom fasting on page 2, which I'll skip. The parable of the sower. Look at the words chosen carefully by Christ. That were on page 3. He sowed the same seed fell by the wayside. And the rest you have read several times. From our commentaries, you know, look at our Lord in his very sharp approach to a problem. Why people mature and grow and others don't? One on the countryside, do you know how strong is that English word indifference? Indifference is the exact translation of the Greek word for doubt. I don't care. That's what Thomas said, actually. I don't care. Reason or not, I don't care, but I care if I can put my... I don't care what about you say. If I don't see him, and I put my finger in the wounds... You know, an indifferent person is someone who doesn't care. Doesn't care. And you know, he neither refuse nor accept. And then the stony ground are those who have no roots. Do you really think that there are people who have no roots? Yes, there are. No roots because there is, you know, there's a good book that needs to be rewritten by one of your pastors. It's called, is it called Life Driven by Purpose or Purpose something?
Yeah, Rick Warren, Purpose
Driven
Life.
Something like that. It's a nice book, very light reading. You know, the disintegration in our life
The disintegration
in our life is that we have many aims. No central aim.
We have many aims, no central aim.
And so we split. And when we split, growth, inner growth, exactly not possible. We may mature here and there, but it gets snuffed. Why is that? Because there is no central purpose. And you know, one of the great mistakes irritates me, that we illustrate the kingdom of God to be here on the right, and the whole world is on the left. And there is no even a road or a channel between the two. A world made of what we call dichotomy.
The dichotomy.
Yeah. But the kingdom of God is in your shop, is in your kitchen, is in your car, is where you live for the King Jesus. No more. It's as easy as making tea and coffee today. When we had the Wednesday morning in our house, one of our ladies gave us a coffee machine. You know, we make coffee. You know, you put the coffee, you boil the water, you know. But that comes in a little cup, you know, you put it, you pull down the thing. And then I said, I'll try it, you know. Had one sip, and I said to me, what is that? And it's coffee. I said, no, this looks like a camel urine, you know. Tastes like, what is that? And she said, where did you ever have a taste of camel urine? I said, in the desert.
Well, it is
something. It doesn't taste like coffee. I'm sorry, I had to drink that.
Not everybody can make Turkish coffee.
Oh, Turkish coffee is divine. Or you know, it tasted nasty. And I said, people drink that?
People
do actually came, stood in line, and each one did that. And I kept looking amazed, actually. And one of them was a good friend. I said, what are you drinking? He said, coffee. Really? He said, yes. You don't like it? I said, no. I did not buy the machine. It's a gift from one of our ladies. but I don't know what they put in these cups, you know. What I'm trying to say is the distorted awareness can make you drink what you don't like. Can make you drive on roads that you never dreamed about. You know. And that, I was talking to a political prisoner who survived solitary imprisonment for 13 years. And he's an MD. My question was simply, he was one of my best friends. He passed away last year, and I really wept for his death because he was one of my best friends. He taught me how to survive crisis. He said, they put me in solitary confinement in order to die. And I decided to live. If you ever get hold of the diaries of the people who were in the Gulag in Siberia under Stalin, and read their diaries, the way they fought death daily, by desiring to live. So how did you live? I said, there was a key, a hole for the key, which I can get some fresh air. And I can talk to the prisoner in the opposite cell. I learned the history of the economy of Egypt through the whole of the key. Another prisoner taught me Persian. And he said, I never forgot that. As long as I'm alive, I cannot forget it. And he said, because I was a prisoner, and I talked to him and he said to me, forget about the day of your leaving. You are here to live for good. Try to make the best out of it. And he said, that is the golden rule. The way we prevail is to accept the tribulation, because acceptance is 50% of the solution. The more we struggle and fight, the more it becomes even heavy. Why? Because it's one purpose. You put me in that din to kill me. I have decided to live. I have one purpose, is to live. One of the things they used to do, the prisoners, is to go through street by street in the commercial part of Cairo and to name the cafes and the shops and the stores and the bookshops in order to stay alive. And if you can imagine, you know, you travel through the whole Cairo by hearing through a little hole. Undivided soul. The more they are distracted, I have a go at the ladies when they say we all, what do we say? Multitasking, right? Okay, that is the way you become senile at the end.
Multitasking.
One thing at a time. What did Christ say to Martha? You think it is psychology? No. You choose one thing and stick to it till you finish it. And then go to the second one. To do two, three things at the same time, I'm sorry. If you're in the mental asylum at the end, blame yourself. The way you live. So, and then the thorns. The thorns are just a divided soul also. So much.
The thorns are a divided soul.
Again, you know, so much around you, utterly unnecessary. Suffocate us.
You know, people put down roots but in the wrong place. You know, I mean, that can be just as devastating as being unfocused. I mean, they'll chase things that aren't that. It might be money, and it could be, you know, I mean, some people are sports fans or whatever, and they think their life, their identity is built around that.
I know, my dear brother, the life has... What is the expectancy of life in America today? Is it 80?
Latin America?
No, in America here. 80?
Close.
Hmm?
Somewhere the same, up to 90. Depends if they have women live longer.
The ones who don't multitask.
Good one,
Peggy. Peggy, it depends how you live. It depends on how you live, the kind of life. It doesn't depend on how long, you know.
How many other parables are there?
14. In Mark, there are 14 parables.
In which Jesus explains the parable, like he does for the parable.
Because, you see, that's a good question. Why did Jesus explain the parable of the sower?
Because he was talking to the disciples.
Oh, talk about Israel also. What do you think was the major problem for the ministry of Jesus? He had it on both sides. Stupid disciples, you know. And
stupid disciples.
And hard-necked Jews. And he, goodness. You know, if you really think he really had a nice time in his ministry, you are wrong. You know, if you really think that it's like today, you know, drive your Cadillac and go to a 4,000 on a Sunday with a nice choir and banners and organ. You really think so? You really think that was the crowd? No. They were expecting a Messiah, but each one has an image of the Messiah. Okay, why do you think Judas betrayed Jesus? No.
Tried to force his hand.
No. No.
He wasn't coming in the image that he thought he was supposed to come.
No. Judas is a member of the Zealots.
Yeah.
Of a terrorist group in our modern vocabulary. And then when he saw that Christ after Palm Sunday does not want to become a king.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Disappointed him.
He disappointed him.
Yeah. You are useless.
Because he wasn't going to be the king.
Okay. Okay, that's easy. What about Peter, Simon Peter? What was the crucial element in the mind of Simon Peter that Christ rebuked him because of it?
Fear.
Huh? No? Not because he healed his mother-in-law. No. When he said the Son of Man will go to Jerusalem and be crucified, oh no, God forbid. And Christ said to him, what?
Yes,
go behind me.
Satan.
That's a terrible word. What was Satan in the life of Jesus? I give you the kingdom of the earth if you kneel down to me. I know. Really stupid disciples.
So
absolutely.
Why did he back to the question, why did he explain this one?
What, Peter?
No, this parable.
Why
so?
Because you see, I am preaching and I'm doing miracles and I've cast out demons, and in your books I am the Messiah, I am the bridegroom of Israel. Why aren't you listening to me? It's not my fault. It's you are not ready to receive the message. You are like the seeds on the road and the seeds between the thorns. And those who listen are the seed on the good earth that will bring fruit. You know, all the parables, all the parables are aiming at revealing the ministry of Jesus to a hostile crowd, actually. You really think that the crowd followed him because of the miracles? In the Gospel of John, chapter 6, when he had a big crowd at the lake, he said, I know why you followed me. Because I gave you free fish and free bread. You know? Yeah, you want to eat? Come and follow Jesus. You know, when you go to Costco on Saturday, sometimes people give you a sample of something.
Thursday, too.
You know, there's a woman giving a kind of chocolate, you know. And I said, can I take one for my wife? And she said, yes. So I said, can I take another one because I'm greedy? And you know what she said to me? Well, it's free. Nobody told me about giving how many pieces I can give to anyone. You want more, you can take more. I said, no. Three, one for me, one for my wife, one extra because I'm greedy. And I kept saying, well, that's exactly the crowd. We followed you because we ate fish and had bread free. Okay? So here is the mystery of the bridegroom. He comes, want to draw us to himself. Some people are drawn to him because they are ready. They are longing for the kingdom. Other people look for something. And when it's not there, go somewhere else. I was in England, and that was very true, in Cambridge. There was a mistake in advertisement on the Saturday morning local newspaper.
A mistake in an ad in the newspaper, Saturday.
That today, from 10 to 11, they're giving free jeans.
Free jeans.
I said, I don't believe it. But the whole university queued for it. Do you know how many people are in the university? 75,000.
No.
Probably more, 75,000.
Yeah. But it was a mistake.
It's a bunch.
It's a mistake in the advertisement. And the manager came out in a loud speaker and said, I'm sorry, boys and girls, there's a mistake. The newspaper has to pay us some money for that. We men, it is half price. And, you know, within minutes, that big crowd diminished to almost one-tenth. What did you buy for half price? You know. Because, you see, there is nothing more attractive than something free that doesn't cost you anything.
Except nobody except Jesus that way. They always have to attach stuff to it.
Anyway, the power of the lamp is very easy to understand, that Christ is the light. Come on, young man, for a little portion of your friend.
On false teaching. False teaching destroys itself. It has the self-killing power that is the lack of the divine touch. How do we see the divine touch? In the teaching of divine mercy.
Oh, slow down. You see the divine touch in the divine mercy. Any teaching that has no mercy, forget it, okay?
Whenever mercy is absent, God is not the subject, but the fallen human perception.
Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Jesus is the lamp that can't be snuffed, but his light comes from within and never was acquired from an outside source. How can anyone hide Jesus? By changing his teaching, which is like putting a lamp under a basket, or by false understanding of his work and his person.
Thank you. You know, you will be surprised if I told you that we met a lady who's a member of an occult group here in Indiana for 14 years.
An occult group in Indiana for 14 years?
Yeah. They studied the Bible back to front in the meeting.
They what?
Studied the Bible. Back to front means completely.
Oh, back to front.
It's an English way of saying, you know,
study the Bible back to front, an occult group.
And then she came to Bible study on Wednesday morning and we thought to learn about divine love. Was hurt, wept, coughed, sneezed. And my wife, God bless her soul, the first thing that notes about the woman that she's dressed almost like a man. Even her hair. So she, another lady, took her to a hairdresser and bought her some nice clothes. When she came to our house, I could not recognize her. And I said, ah, now you look like a lady. And she said, George, for 14 years, I was taught not even to think about myself. And I said, but yourself is the focus of the divine love. And she said, no. Myself, I am a sinner. And I said, but you could be a sinner under God's mercy. You know, whenever she mentioned something about sin, I give her something else. And she would reply back, And I said, you are not really free from your occult group. Takes a while. And you know, she really looked pretty. And they did what you call the nail and thing. I said, even your fingers look like a woman's fingers, you know. They look like a claws of a raven or something before.
Claws of a raven.
And you know, 4 years we struggled with that woman till she has been born again through the divine love. Born out of God's love. That's the light of Jesus that shines. You know, you hear false teaching and it is bounded by verse from verse. But the selected verse, not a holistic, complete picture. Now she's free. I look at her and say, Lord, you are truly good. You can make even miracles in our time by changing a shadow of a human person and to make that person truly real. May God be glorified in our life, my friends.
Thank you, George.
Because outside Christ, there is nothing but darkness. And he is not a familiar figure that we can box him and put him in a religious box. He is always unfamiliar. Challenge us. Every parable is a challenge to all of us. Sleep well and don't dream about your former sins. Dream about heaven for a change. Don't miss next Wednesday. Continue with the parables. And I'm preparing a nice piece of steak for you.